Die Übersetzung von Jans Stimme vom Deutschen ins Englische wurde mit einer KI erstellt.
It has now been 5 years since the Taliban retook power in Afghanistan. Since then, there has been no war in the country. For 40 years, people in Afghanistan had to endure war. The war against the Soviets, who invaded the country in 1979, then the Afghan Civil War, then the rise of the Taliban for the first time, the 20-year occupation that began in 2001, and throughout all those years, the country was repeatedly shaken by conflict. Now there is a relatively stable peace. Reconstruction is underway and people are returning. But what does this new stability actually mean for the people living there? A teacher in Kabul says,
"We are not pessimistic, but optimistic. We hope that this situation will not continue and that their decisions and attitudes will change. Perhaps there is a problem or a reason why you haven't started yet. You know this best. We hope that the education system will improve and that schools and universities will reopen for girls. Every Afghan family dreams of their daughter becoming a doctor or an engineer. What else can we do? We can only hope."
Hope in this conversation is not some grand political program. It is more of what remains for Rohina, and not just for her, but for millions of other women in Afghanistan.
In Crisis Mode, the podcast from Conflict Zones with Jan Jessen.
Hello, I'm Jan Jessen, political editor-in-chief and war and crisis reporter for Funke Media Group. 5 years ago, the Taliban retook power in Afghanistan. At the time, on August 15, 2021, I was there. It was an extremely chaotic, turbulent, and of course, deeply troubling time. There was panic. I witnessed how people streamed toward the airport, with hundreds and thousands of them desperately trying to find a way out of the country. For me personally, I have to say, it remains a deeply shocking and traumatizing experience to this day. I have never felt as bad in my entire career as a journalist as I did back then, when I arrived at the airport with my German passport, and people were grabbing at me saying, "Sir, sir, please help me, help me, help me." And of course, there was nothing I could do. I simply walked through with my passport. The American Marines had fought their way through, clearing a path for us, and then we made our way onto the planes. That was a very bitter moment, I have to say. Today, the major fighting has ended in many parts of the country. And that is actually one of the things most people tell you when you talk to them. Ordinary people who come from the provinces to Kabul, for example. They say that for the first time in 40 years, they can essentially travel safely and freely from even the most remote parts of the country to the capital. They no longer have to constantly fear falling into the hands of one warlord or another. They no longer have to worry about bombs going off somewhere or roadside explosives detonating, many of which were planted by the Taliban at the time. So the major war, those 4 decades of war, is over. The security situation is significantly better than it was during the years of war, and that also applies to everyday crime. In the past, you simply weren't supposed to go out at night in Kabul or other cities. Everyday crime was pretty severe. That has largely come to an end today. It still happens occasionally, of course, but by and large, people can now move around the country, and that is a major change. At the same time, however, poverty, unemployment, and hunger are enormous. Afghanistan is truly a country in desperate need. And particularly, you have probably heard this in many places already, the situation for women and girls in Afghanistan is catastrophic. For them, their homeland has become a completely different country. They are no longer allowed to attend secondary school. They are no longer allowed to study at university. And they have been pushed out of many professions. I recently went back to Afghanistan and wanted to find out what these 5 years actually look like in everyday life. Once again, I traveled with Friedensdorf International, an organization from Oberhausen. We've already introduced them to you on the podcast. They have been working in Afghanistan since 1988, bringing sick and injured children from Afghanistan to Germany for treatment. This time I witnessed the medical selection process again. Basically, parents bring their children there in the hope that Friedensdorf will take them to Germany. The children are examined by doctors and by staff members of Friedensdorf, and only a very small number of them can actually be taken. It is always a very painful situation, I have to say. More than 1,500 children were presented this time. Only 80 can be brought to Germany. And of course you witness scenes there that are extremely difficult to see. But I also had the opportunity to look around the country. I spent time in Kabul, the capital of Afghanistan, and, among other places, I found a state-run primary school in a side street in the northwest of the city. The school was housed in an ordinary residential building. It was 3 stories high, and more than 1,100 children were being taught there in 4 shifts. From the top floor all the way down to the basement, virtually every room was being used as a classroom. There were also 2 additional tents in the courtyard. It was absolutely packed when I was there. The head of the school is Rohina Popel, and there is something quite remarkable about her. The entire teaching staff consisted exclusively of women. Rohina Popel was a very tough woman, I have to say. She also did not cover her face, as has increasingly become the norm in many parts of Afghanistan. Instead, she spoke to the camera with her face uncovered and talked to me very openly about how she sees the situation. Girls still attend her school, at least through 6th grade. But for many, probably most of them, their educational journey ends after 6th grade, long before they ever reach university.
We try to ensure the girls get an education. They should be able to work and have a profession later, just like us. But we deeply regret the current situation. What can we do? We have no options. In the past 5 years, no female doctors or engineers have graduated in Afghanistan. Many other professions also remain closed to women.
You hear this from many, many people, but it primarily concerns the situation in the major cities, places like Kabul, Herat, Mazar-i-Sharif in the north, and others, where, during the 20 years before the Taliban returned to power, it had become completely normal for young women to attend university, pursue higher education, and work in the public administration or in businesses. Unfortunately, that has now come to an end, at least for the time being. For example, the younger sister of a doctor who works for Friedensdorf had studied medicine. After the Taliban took power, she had to abandon her studies, and now she sits at home. For women affected by this, it is, of course, extremely bitter. However, and this is also an important part of the truth, it is a problem that actually affects a relatively small proportion of the population, because many women and young girls did not attend school or university, even during the 20-year occupation by Western powers, such as the United States. Particularly in rural areas, there are still very small-scale farming communities and deeply conservative social structures. It was therefore not common for women to pursue higher education or to work outside the family business. The same applies to girls' education. Many girls were unable to attend school. And, incidentally, this is also true of many boys. In Afghanistan, you see many, many young boys out on the streets, working, selling things, or in rural areas, working in the fields from a very young age. Nevertheless, as I said, for the women who are now no longer allowed to study or work, the situation is catastrophic. And Rohina sees firsthand what happens to women when suddenly every prospect for the future is taken away from them.
Many women in Afghanistan are suffering greatly from this situation. They don't want to spend the rest of their lives sitting in a corner of the house. They have desires and ambitions of their own. But what can they do? Many suffer from severe mental health problems. Some have even attempted suicide.
What is striking, of course, is how cautious Rohina is when she talks about the political situation. I had made it very clear to her that she was speaking to a journalist and that I would, of course, like to publish what she was telling us. And given the situation, she was accordingly cautious, which I think is a good thing. I mean, it would obviously have been fatal if she had put herself in danger. As I said, she's a teacher at a state-run primary school. She's still allowed to work there, and that's obviously a good thing. She herself studied political science, and when our conversation became a little more political, she immediately drew a line there as well.
I don't want to delve too deeply into politics. I studied political science, but I don't want to elaborate on it further. From our perspective, the international community and the United Nations aren't doing enough to address our concerns. If they did more, development would proceed more quickly and smoothly. There are many discussions, but not enough concrete actions.
Rohina doesn't say much about the Taliban themselves, and I think that's sensible too. As I said, she's speaking to people from abroad, and so I think it's right and important to be cautious and, as I said, not put yourself in danger. She is more outspoken, though, when she talks about the international community, and despite everything, she doesn't want to give up hope.
We are not pessimistic, but optimistic. We hope that this situation will not continue and that their decisions and attitudes will change. Perhaps there is a problem or a reason why you haven't started yet. You know this best. We hope that the education system will improve and that schools and universities will reopen for girls. Every Afghan family dreams of their daughter becoming a doctor or an engineer. What else can we do? We can only hope.
Rohina continues to teach every day, bringing her students to this school. But whether they will ever be allowed to go on to university, nobody knows. At the same time, when you talk to representatives of the Taliban, when you talk to people from various organizations, you very often hear in the background that even the Taliban themselves, or at least some of them, are not entirely happy with the decisions that are currently being made, with the way women are increasingly being pushed to the margins. It actually comes up again and again in these conversations. People say, we're basically maneuvering ourselves into a dead end if we don't allow girls and women to attend secondary schools or go to university, because at some point we're going to be short of female doctors, and at some point we're going to be short of female teachers. And so, even within the ranks of the Taliban themselves, there are people who keep saying, what's happening right now is not good. We also have to think about the future of our people. We can't exclude half of the population from education. And on the other hand, some of the more pragmatic people among the Taliban also know that what they're doing is not being viewed very positively by the rest of the world. European countries, in particular Western countries, are finding it very, very difficult to establish contact with the Taliban, to enter into dialogue with them, if they continue to treat women and girls the way they are doing now. Some of the more pragmatic people know this, and I think that, hopefully, over the coming months and years, we will see some things start to move on this issue. From Kabul, I continued on to Logar province, and there I encountered a very different perspective on the past 5 years. Abdulrahman Bhatti has been working in a brick factory for more than 25 years, and it's really quite fascinating. When you drive a little further out into the countryside, suddenly you have these huge flat expanses, and everywhere you see chimneys. They're maybe 20 meters high, also built out of bricks themselves, and completely black smoke is rising from them. And around these chimneys, there are these pits, and the bricks are put into these pits. Everything is done by hand. The bricks are shaped by hand from clay and sand and then dried in the sun. And then there are these donkey carts. The bricks are taken to the pits on these donkey carts, and the pits are then filled in. Then the whole thing is heated with coal, and that's how the bricks are fired. So it's still a very, very archaic way of making bricks. The brickworks I visited there, the one run by Abdulrahman Bhatti, produce 7 million of these bricks a year, and according to him, it employs more than 250 people. He then explained to me in detail once again how these bricks are made.
You can see the people there. They sit and shape the bricks by hand. Then we lay them out on an open area for 2 or 3 days so they can dry. After that, a group comes who work with donkeys. The workers put the bricks on the donkeys and take them to the kiln. There we put in coal and fire the bricks.
And what I found really interesting in the conversation was that Abdulrahman said his business has grown over the past 5 years. One thing that keeps standing out to us, or that keeps standing out to me whenever I travel through Afghanistan, is that there is a huge amount of construction going on. In Kabul, new roads are being built, and new roads are also being built out into the provinces. A lot of new houses are being built as well. And yeah, as I said, Abdulrahman also said that his brick business has benefited quite a lot from all of this.
Our business has grown over the last 5 years. We are much more satisfied today. There used to be perhaps 700 or 800 factories here. Now there are only about 250 or 300. The demand for our bricks is significantly higher. That's why we are satisfied with our work today.
Yeah, that's his personal experience as a brick producer. But it's actually in contrast to the economic situation of many people in Afghanistan. Unemployment and poverty are widespread. Millions of people depend on humanitarian aid. According to organizations such as the United Nations, around a third of the people in Afghanistan are malnourished. We also see this again and again in these presentations of the children I mentioned earlier. You saw quite a few children who were really extremely thin, emaciated almost to the bone, and who looked absolutely terrible with these very sunken eyes and everything. They were basically on the verge of starving to death. And yeah, demand in Abdulrahman's business has gone up, and he links that to one development in particular, the improved security situation that I mentioned earlier.
Today, the security situation in Afghanistan is good. People living abroad are returning and staying with their families. However, a persistent problem lies with land ownership issues. The government repeatedly declares that certain settlements are state property, which is why people are sometimes unable to build houses there. We hope that the government will clarify these issues in the future and legally secure the private land. This will lead to increased construction and a corresponding rise in demand, not only for bricks, but also for sand and cement. More workers will be needed for construction, and more houses will create more jobs.
You hear this again and again. Afghans living in exile, in the diaspora, whether in America or in Europe, are now investing heavily. They're building houses, building hotels, building restaurants, things like that. Things they simply didn't dare to do over the past few decades because the security situation was so problematic. Nobody knew what was actually going to happen to my house. Is it possibly going to be bombed? Are there going to be some kind of legal problems? And now there seems to be much more confidence in the stability of the country, so people are now investing quite a lot of money after all. For Abdulrahman, the improved security situation means one thing above all. People are investing again, building houses, creating jobs. That's another side, another face of Afghanistan 5 years after the Taliban took power. Abdulrahman says Afghanistan is safer today. But that doesn't apply to all parts of the country. I traveled from Logar to Paktia, near the border with Pakistan. And there I met someone for whom that statement probably sounds a little cynical. His name was Fathullah. He's 35 years old and a doctor. And when I met him, he was standing in the ruins of his house. And the village where I was, it was actually a really picturesque village. You had the mountains in the background, the border with Pakistan just a few kilometers away, and lots of little houses. Everything very orderly. But this house had probably been the most impressive one in the village, and it hadn't even been standing for very long. He told me that he had lived there with his 35 family members for just 2 years. The house was 3 stories high, and on June 28th, shortly after 11 p.m., it was attacked by a Pakistani fighter jet. A missile hit the second floor, in the room where Fathullah's 14-year-old brother Lokman had been sleeping, and he was killed in the attack. Fathullah then showed me his phone and showed me a photo of his brother, and he said he was just a student. He hadn't done anything to anyone. Fathullah himself and his wife were also seriously injured in the attack. His right arm was shattered, shrapnel hit his leg and his upper body, and, well, you could still see it on him. His right arm was still covered in scars, with this huge scar where the arm had been shattered. What was particularly horrific was that after the house was attacked, the villagers came to help, and then the property was attacked a second time. When the villagers came to help us, there was another military strike. There was a second attack, this time targeting the people who had come to help.
Then when our villager have come from our helping to help it as again, a military attack have come and second, the attack on us, on this villager.
That was a double-tap attack. This happens again and again in war situations. It's really more like a terrorist attack. In Ukraine, for example, it happens all the time that the Russians attack with drones and destroy or damage a house, say a residential building. Then the rescue workers come, and then a second drone comes in and attacks the rescue workers. I've seen this happen again and again in Iraq as well, in attacks by ISIS, the so-called Islamic State. They would send in suicide bombers, and after one of them had blown himself up and people came to help, the second one would come, usually with an even bigger bomb. Fathullah told me that a total of 16 people were killed and 176 injured in the two attacks. These figures cannot be independently verified. The Afghan authorities, however, also reported numerous civilian casualties. Pakistan, on the other hand, says that its attacks targeted militant positions. What I found really bitter was that, in one corner of the courtyard of this destroyed house, the sandals of the people who had been injured in the attack were still lying there, and Fathullah himself, as I've just said, is still carrying the scars of the attack on his body, but presumably also in his soul.
I am injured here, mm-hmm. also here. Broken. My arm is also broken.
Mm.
Now I have tech and plaster here.
Yeah, this attack on the house was not an isolated incident. Afghanistan and Pakistan are basically in an undeclared war. Since October of last year, the Pakistanis have been carrying out attacks in Afghanistan relatively frequently. On the other side, the Taliban keep attacking Pakistani border posts in the border region and even send small drones into Pakistan themselves. Why this war? Well, there are probably different reasons for it. One of the most important reasons, in my view, is that the Taliban have now developed quite good relations with India. India is Pakistan's arch enemy. The two countries have already fought several wars against each other, and last year there were serious fears that it could potentially escalate into a nuclear war. And during the years of the occupation, the Western occupation of Afghanistan, the Pakistanis, the Pakistani Intelligence Service, ISI, basically, above all, supported the Taliban. They made them stronger, financed them, trained them, provided them with safe havens and so on. And the idea was that, in the event of a war with India, so if Pakistan went to war with India, Afghanistan could serve as strategic depth if there was a friendly government there. And now that the Taliban have moved closer to the Indians, there's a lot of exchange, economic relations and so on. The Pakistanis obviously feel a little bit boxed in. They may also be angry, disappointed, whatever it is, that the horse they backed suddenly isn't doing what they want it to do anymore. And now Pakistan is accusing the Taliban in Afghanistan of sheltering representatives of the Pakistani Taliban, they exist as well, who repeatedly carry out attacks in Pakistan. The Afghans, the Taliban, in turn say that Pakistan is sheltering Islamic State fighters, who then repeatedly carry out attacks in Afghanistan. So, as you can see, the whole situation is very tangled and very difficult. But as I said, it's a war, a relatively low-level war. It hasn't fully broken out yet, but there have already been numerous deaths, particularly among the civilian population. And unfortunately, Fathullah and his family have had to experience that firsthand. There are also repeated security incidents elsewhere in Afghanistan, for example, in the provinces of Nuristan and Badakhshan. There are various insurgent groups there, all small, very local militias, that keep trying to rise up against the Taliban. It works more or less well. At the moment, the Taliban's rule is definitely not under threat, but there are always individual areas in Afghanistan that remain relatively unsettled. At the end of my journey, these are the three encounters that stay with me. Rohina in Kabul, who continues to teach her students without knowing whether they will ever be allowed to go to university. Abdul Rahman in Logar, whose business is growing because people are building and investing again. And Fathullah in Paktia, standing in front of the ruins of his house and showing me on his phone a picture of his 14-year-old brother, who was killed. Afghanistan is safer today in many parts of the country than it was during the long years of war. But safety definitely doesn't automatically mean freedom, and it doesn't apply everywhere or to everyone. So perhaps the crucial question isn't just, has Afghanistan become safer, but safer for whom? That was today's episode of our podcast, Im Krisen Modus. This podcast was produced by Alexander Baumeister. He's also a journalist and works for a radio station belonging to the Funke Media Group. If you enjoyed the podcast, please like and follow us. That definitely helps us make our work more visible. And feel free to write to me if you have a suggestion for one of our episodes. You can reach us at krisenmodus@funkemedien.de. And perhaps think about that question once again. Who does security actually mean security for? And what does a country lose when its people can build again, but are not free to decide what they want their future to look like? Take care of yourselves. See you next time. Ciao, ciao.
In Crisis Mode, the podcast from Conflict Zones with Jan Jessen.
Podcast von Funke.